I'd been asked actually many times before because as I spoke right now, my friend Liz is very outspoken, ESPN, and she's all these different radio shows and interviews. And she asked me a few times the past year and I turned everything down. But when I was given this opportunity, I felt like knowing that so many women are going through this and so many men are suffering and there's so much shame. No one wants to talk about it. I just thought it's our duty, you know, to get this out there.
Are more conversations happening about the impact of on what's happening with the football players' brains themselves, but less conversations happening about the repercussions of that, not just for the players themselves, but the families, right. You as the wife and the entire family structure. And so that's a new narrative that's emerging that shows the startling impact of all of this. So tell us a little bit, if you can, about your family's experience and your experience.
Well, that's exactly what I thought was different. I thought, you know, we've heard these stories of guys dying over and over and over, but nobody understand. And they say, you know, these guys, they signed up for this. Like, they're kind of getting what they deserve, which, you know, I hate that statement. But they say that. And my response would be to that, well, I don't believe that, but am I getting, you know, do I deserve this? Do my children deserve this? We had no idea about any kind of football disease. I wasn't with him when he played. And yes, it affects everyone. I mean, obviously it affects the family, the wife and the children the most because we're dealing with it every day. But the parents, my parents, I mean, it's a ripple effect and, everybody, is impacted by it. And it's just really, really, it's a very difficult thing and we get by it day by day. But, I think, you know, for the children that they have to, you know, and if they're younger and they're older, they have to see this change happen in their father, or the younger ones, they never got to see the way that their dad used to be. And they have to constantly hear about, you know, that there's something wrong with their dad. There's something wrong with his brain. And this is the way it is. And it doesn't feel fair, you know, that we just didn't know. I wish we could have known because we could have had a different choice and a different life.
Well, how did Rob's brain injuries as a result of football, how did that manifest itself in the family and in day-to-day life?
Well, he used to be just the most patient dad. And I was a teacher, you know, worked with young children, and I couldn't believe how he could just play dollhouse or push the girls on the swings for hours and hours, and he wouldn't get bored, or, you know, playing out in the snow, or, you know, jumping in mud puddles and playing dollhouse and all this stuff. And he's such a hands-on father, holding his baby, my stepdaughter, carrying her everywhere and just playing with her and laughing with her. And then I watched this change happen in him where he just shut down, and all of a sudden he didn't have the patience. He would get agitated and irritable so quickly. And, you know, children are, you have to have a lot of patience. They're jumping all over you and they want your time and they want your attention. And he has to work really hard now to be able to do that. And he tries, you know, he waits till he's feeling good. And then they call it, let's play the daddy game. And he goes downstairs with them and he plays this kind of roughhouse game with them. They jump on him and stuff, but it has to be when he's feeling okay. It can't just be spontaneous, like, let's go do this right now, like it used to be. You have to, and I'm always like, daddy's not feeling good right now. Just give him his space. Maybe tomorrow will be a better day. And, that's how it affects us. It's just, it's different. Every day is just a struggle of, we're every moment, really, every hour of just, let's get through this hour and let's, he's got to constantly check himself, his emotions. I have to shoulder the stress. I've got to make sure that he's not getting too stressed out because he could just snap and yell and get angry. So it's a lot of kind of buffering, and that's been going on for years. I didn't even really realize I was doing it. And now I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I would just take on everything. I'll get the groceries. I'll pay the bills. I'll do the taxes. Because I could tell that he would get so stressed out by doing it. It was the stuff that he used to do all the time. And so I instinctively, I took it on so that I thought the less stress, you know, and then he'll be okay. Now that we know so much that it's his brain, he can kind of try to realize this is something that's going on, that maybe, you know, I remove myself from the situation, take a walk. He does those things now because we really have focused on the fact that, you know, this is a brain injury.
And getting that diagnosis, was that a big turning point then? Because I know there was so much uncertainty and isolation, because I think you thought you were the only person dealing with this until you joined a closed Facebook group and you saw all of these other families dealing with pretty much identical behaviors.
That was what really changed it for me, was speaking with the other women, because we had, you know, in 2013, we received paperwork. Football is the cause of neurological symptoms. He's permanently disabled. So you'd think at that point, okay, we know football did this, but you're just in denial. Even then it was so hard to face. And I was just scared to face that. I thought maybe his brain chemistry changed a little bit, but I just didn't want to think about a brain disease or CTE. That was just too terrifying. But when I started to meet these women and speak with them, and the stories were just down to the specific symptoms of obsessively washing laundry. I mean, that kind of stuff would just shock me. Or like, you know, throwing out things that were new, or you know, throwing out some new food, or throwing out new clothes and stuff. Just, I was shocked. And then I started to realize I can't be in denial anymore. We're all dealing with this, and it's because of football, and his brain has changed, and it's easier. I really, really have a lot of compassion, and I feel for the women 10 years ago that had no idea, because they didn't, and they'll say it, we didn't know this was because of football, and I just thought it was my fault. I thought he was going crazy, and you know, they end up getting divorced. And then, you know, these men, when they're on their own, they really, really have a difficult time functioning. They need to have the support of somebody there. And so, you know, it was just, it's very, very helpful to know. I mean, in being informed, you can't put a price tag on that. And that's why it's so important that we speak out to help people.
In terms of the NFL's response to all of this, they have been much criticized for lack of response, the speed of the response, and the pace of compensation. I know there is a lawsuit, and I know there has been a fund that's been set up to help former players as well. I mean, what's your overall sense of how it's been dealt with at an organizational level?
You know, I mean, I think it's their responsibility they're going to protect themselves. They want to make money. They're not a health organization. But, you know, it was obviously really corrupt for them to hide that information, and the terms of the settlement, and it's amazing. And people realize this, but it's uncapped. It's over $1 billion, and they are willing to pay over $1 billion so they do not have to reveal how long they knew that football caused brain injury, and that how long they knew about this brain disease. So, you know, that's obviously extremely corrupt and very frustrating. And we're part of the settlement right now. And it's just been going on. And all these men have died in the process. And, you know, there's this saying, like, deny, delay, hope, delay, deny, hope they die. That a lot of the families feel like they're just waiting and waiting. And then these guys are just dying off and they don't have to pay them. And so there's a lot of frustration with the NFL. But it even goes, you know, bigger than that. I mean, the NFL compensates us. So there's some level of like, okay, well, they compensate us, and I'm glad for that. But what about the universities? I mean, Rob played at the college level. He played for 5 years at the university, and he didn't get paid a cent. So where's their responsibility in this? I wonder, you know, is that maybe the next conversation? And I know, like, right now we're trying to, and my friends are working on stopping the tackle football under 12 years old, trying to ban it, which I think is great. So going after the young, you know, the youth sports, the youth football is a really important thing. And I also think that we should, you know, think about how the universities can, you know, do something, have some change can happen where they can take some responsibility too.
But you bring up a point I really wanted to touch on, because when you said you feel responsibility to speak out. I mean, there are so many people listening right now who maybe have a kid playing football, maybe have gone to college football games or professional football games and have participated in this entire national obsession in some way, either as a spectator, as a fan, or a family member, without really thinking of the broader implications of this. Now, I know in Europe and countries that play rugby, there was a change in rules when there was a crisis level of spinal injuries. And it was tackled by changing the rules of the game. And I have not seen that discussion happening when it comes to American football.
Yep. Yeah, well, you make a great point. Like, I feel like we've been totally desensitized. I mean, you'd think logically, oh my gosh, you know, this is such a brutal game. Of course it's not going to be good for the brain. Of course it's not good for 9-year-olds to be out there smashing their heads all day long. But it's so normal to us because we've grown up watching it. So we don't even think about the fact, you know, what are we really watching? We're watching these men are sacrificing their brains for our entertainment. That's really what's happening. And, you know, and the children, I mean, our son obviously will not play, but there has to be some change. And I think I would love for some more science. Dr. Bennett Omalu, who's the man who discovered CTE, and I'm just, you know, forever grateful for him. He's an amazing man. And he's spoken out, and Dr. Ann McKee is amazing, but we have to have the scientists continue to say, you know, that this is dangerous, and cut, you know, the age level's got to be cut. I don't know what the safe age is, but I mean, these young children, it's not right. And whatever can be done to make it safer, I don't know what that is. I mean, I can't say what needs to be done, but it definitely needs to be a discussion. We can't just put our heads in the sand and, you know, just be like, oh, it's such entertainment. It's so great. It's such an American sport. It's beautiful. And yes, it is beautiful, but it's also extremely brutal and violent. And we are the ones with the families are the ones that deal with the repercussions years later.
Well, Rob, you're here in the studio with us, and I know that Emily really is a spokesperson for your family on this, but would you like to say anything on this? No? Okay.
He'd love to be able to, it's, you know, it's funny, the wives are always saying, we'd love to start a group for our guys to get together, but we know there'd be, you know, two words and then no, you know, nobody would continue on because women are just better at this communication thing. And plus part of the CTE thing is, you know, not being able to talk. When you're feeling depressed, you just shut off and shut down. And I try to help Rob a lot, like with like just keeping the train of thought going. And if he loses his train of thought, like reminding him, bringing him back to what he was saying. And because he's very good at explaining what it feels like to be going through this, you know, what, when you are in this dark, deep depression, what you are feeling. And he describes it to me all the time, what he's feeling. He's got a lot better of kind of tapping into that body awareness and like real, you know, being in his body and okay, this is what I'm feeling. It's been helpful. So,
well, I understand that Emily is speaking on everyone's behalf. But if I could just ask you one thing, knowing what you know now and your experience, would you have picked up a football when you were that young kid back when you first got into it?
Well, I mean, hindsight's 20/20. And, you know, growing up in the Midwest is football country. Is, you know, it's you know, your parents grew up rooting, you know, for the university that, you know, I attended. You know, all my friends and family were fans, so it was a huge deal. You know, my high school was a huge deal, won the state championship there. So, I mean, it was success after success. So, I mean, like, you know, there was a part of it that was really, you know, where you see people and you understand why, you know, they question why a guy like me would come out and say, there's no way that I would play football if I knew what I knew now. I mean, like, I wouldn't wish upon my worst enemy what I go through daily. And I'm not saying this for sympathy. I'm just being honest so people can understand. It's not, we didn't all make, trust me, we're not all millionaires. That's few and far between. We're mostly guys out there that are just busting their butt to stay on the team. And we're the ones that are making the big 40-yard run down the field punt hits and that kind of stuff. And, you know, we lay it on the line for, you know, for the fans. And there's this whole thing about, like, the NFL is this big family and all this kind of stuff. But yet, like, you know, when there's these stories that come out, like, you know, as brilliant as Emily's was in the New York Times, that, I mean, which was a warning piece to people, more of like, that it goes so unnoticed by the NFL, how they totally disregard something like that. But yet Johnny Manziel, you know, they find out he's all of a sudden bipolar and they start, you know, making symptoms that are very similar to CTE, and you're like, can't you see this is something?
If I could add in, I mean, there's something that we've learned, that I've learned with the wives is that, you know, the wives that have older husbands who might be in their 60s, they'll say, yes, in your 20s and 30s, you get diagnosed as being bipolar. And then in your 40s and 50s, you get diagnosed as being having dementia. And it's really neither of those things. It's CTE and it mimics it. So the early, you know, there's different levels of CTE. Early CTE, you know, level one, level two manifests as bipolar symptoms because you're having mood swings and you're depressed and you're impulsive. And because they can't diagnose you CTE, they go, oh, you must be bipolar. And then later, as you get a little older, you have those same symptoms, but then you're having memory issues. And they go, well, we don't know what this is. I guess, you know, you have dementia. But it's different. And it's not exactly like bipolar. It's not exactly like dementia. But, you know, what else can you call it? Because you can't call it this brain disease. So whenever I hear about these young guys and they're saying, oh, they've got a bipolar diagnosis, my heart just stops because I'm like, you know, that's what they said about Rob. And now we know it's not that. And, you know, now it's like, oh, now they say, well, it's just brain injury. You know, he went to the brain injury treatment center. It's brain injury. It's not even, they don't call it bipolar anymore. That's what they did when he was in his 30s. They said, it seems like, I mean, never got a full diagnosis, but like, yeah, this seems like bipolar symptoms. So it's, look out for that. I mean, that is a warning when, you know, I hear my friends' husbands who are 60 and they say, oh yeah, they were diagnosed bipolar when they were 30 years old. And, you know, now there's like the symptoms are so severe that they get lost when they walk a block down the street. That's not being bipolar.
Now, is more research being done? I mean, separate from the NFL, is independent research being done? Is a body of knowledge now being accumulated?
Well, I know the Boston University, Dr. Ann McKee, who's amazing, and everyone who has played in the NFL, you know, if they pledge to donate their brains, that's going to help people down the line. And, you know, Rob is going to do it. His dad is going to do it. And I think there are, you know, a lot of the neurologists we have spoken to and doctors and brain injury, you know, they're very interested in what's going on with Rob because I think they want to, you know, how can we treat this? This is, we're just learning about it. Maybe there's a way to treat it. And, you know, what we've used and what works amazingly is cannabis. We use that as a medication. He takes the same amount every morning. If he's not on it, it's not good. It's really, really not good. I mean, it's, to me, it seems like he's got some kind of inflammation in his brain because I liken it to someone who has a headache and they take an Advil. So you've got a headache, you take an Advil, and the symptoms, it kicks in, you know, 10 minutes, you feel better. As it starts to wear off, the headache comes back. So Rob takes his cannabis. It kicks in about 20 minutes. He can go from being, you know, in a rage to be not making sense, incoherent, to all of a sudden he's lucid, he's calm, he's rational. But then as it starts to leave his system, those things start to come up again, a little bit of a paranoia, a little bit of OCD stuff. And then I'm like, Rob, I think you need to take your cannabis again. You know, the time, we'll try to time it every day at the same time. It's 4 p.m., time to take it. He goes back to normal. But you know, when we went on vacation and we're running out, you know, that's when you see it all. And it's terrifying because you realize it's doing something to his brain to make him normal. But without it, you know, I don't know where he'd be if he didn't have it.
Well, of course, you're living in a state that you have access to it. Is that why you moved to Colorado?
That was one of the big reasons. Yep. We moved because of the sunshine. We moved because, I mean, it's beautiful. But he in Ohio, there was a few times where he was able to take it, and it was miraculous. I couldn't believe how he would take it, and he would just be this different person. He'd be hungry, he'd sleep great, he'd sleep through the night, and I was like, you need to have this. This is amazing. I mean, this is a miracle medication to me. I'm seeing it before my very eyes, and maybe it sounds counterintuitive that you take marijuana and it makes you not paranoid, but that's exactly what I've seen over and over and over again. So coming out here and, you know, and when we first came, you know, he would take it. It was just, he wasn't taking it all the time. So he'd have a good day and then he wouldn't have it. And then it'd be bad days. But we realized, you know, every single morning, take it at the exact same time. And since he's been doing that for the past, you know, whatever, 4 months, he's gained 40 pounds.
And yet the NFL, I think, had a zero tolerance policy for players consuming
but you can
cannabis.
Drink. You can drink. And that's, they'll tell you, these neuropathologists will say, the worst thing that you can do to the brain when you've had these brain injuries and your brain becomes very fragile, you know, even if you haven't played for 20 years, is to drink, because it's so toxic to the brain. And you really, really have to be careful of that. And I always tell, you know, a new wife joins the group and she's telling the same symptoms, which I know. And I say, you know, I don't want to come off as I'm being judgmental or telling anyone what to do, but I say, if you can get your husband to stop drinking, please, please do, because it'll make the symptoms progress a lot faster.
And yet so many players and former players do drink. In a way, it's self-medicating.
They are. It's, you know, Rob used to drink. He's been sober for 8 years. So he used to drink. And the crazy thing, and I've talked to the brain injury specialists about this, 10 years ago when he would drink and he would like black out, and he'd black out because of the concussion. So he'd have a few drinks and immediately black out. Now, if he's stone cold sober, he's no cannabis, he is the exact same way that he was then in a blackout rage. His eyes change, his eyes become dark, and he's not there. And he goes into a rage, and I can tell that I can't connect with, it's not Rob, it's not my husband, I can't connect with him. And I told the brain injury specialist this. I said, it's like the way he was 10 years ago when he'd be in a blackout, you know, drunk blackout. And he said, well, what's happening is his frontal lobes shut off. And he's basically, the only part of his brain that's functioning at that time is the amygdala, which is like the caveman part of the brain. It's the fight or flight. And that's why you can't reason with him. Like, he isn't there. And Rob even doesn't really like remember, you know, when he has those moments, he's like, I don't really have a recollection, because he's, you know, the part of the brain that is memory is not even functioning at that point. So, yeah, I mean, you can see how drinking would be very, very dangerous to do when you have this.
And I'd say that's a big part of my day, is consumed by monitoring myself, monitoring my levels inside. Like, you know, a doctor give me a thing, you know, it's, you know, do your thing from 1 to 10. You know, I'm like, I'm already at a 5 when I wake up. You know, a good day is like a 7. You know, I can be, you know, between like 4 and 6 usually, but it's self-regulation and communication with Emily about when I start to feel this wave come upon me of, it's like having 100 panic attacks. Your stomach feels gut. I mean, like, just the decision to go and walk in the morning can be gut-wrenchingly hard. It feels like I'm going to vomit. It makes me think I'm going to, like, lose my mind. It makes me, there's something inside me that says, stay inside. Don't go outside. You know, you're safe here, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's that thing that I've learned to tap into of, like, saying, no, I've got to, you know, get beyond that point. And that's kind of like, you know, hopefully we'll all get to tell, where I'm trying to reach out to guys and saying, hey, there is hope. There is, even though I do have my dark days, you know, you can have better ones.
Well, that's why I'm so appreciative of you coming in. I know it's very difficult to share such a personal story, but I also know many people are listening who are on that spectrum, as is the entire society, of participating in football in some kind of way. And just as I finish up, Rob, do you watch football? Can you watch a game now?
I stopped watching last year for the first time. it was an interesting year. I mean, no, I at first I thought it was going to be really difficult, but I came to the realization that it was becoming so traumatic that when I would, you know, when I would go to the games and I'd hear people cheer and I'd see somebody get, like, just, you know, a big hit, and I would think to myself of the, you know, I wouldn't just think of the player, I'd think of the wife or the girlfriend or the parents. Like, you don't, my parents are still dealing with this. Like, you know, the worry that they go through daily with me still. I mean, they worry about me, like, you know, I feel bad that, you know, that's the part of guilt that you feel because of this, you know, that it's, It's something that, you know, you wouldn't wish upon your worst enemy. You wouldn't.
Well, Emily, what's next now for you and your work, now that you really have become or stepped into that space of speaking out about the impact on families and wives?
Well, I feel more brave and courageous to do it. I was really nervous and afraid previously, but I just, you know, I thought anything worthwhile in life is hard. And sometimes you just have to put yourself out there, and you have to be brave if you want to do something good. If you know, I said to Rob too, I was like, we've been through so much suffering, and don't you want something good to come from this? And he's like, yes. Because I mean, before it got posted, it was like, do we do this? Like, this, it was scary. It was to put yourself out. It's just scary. And we both agreed, like, let's have something positive come from this, because if it helps someone to not put their son in football, if it helps a man who's suffering and thinking about suicide, if it helps a wife who's about to leave her husband, I mean, whatever, just if it's just one person, if it's just a few people, it matters and it makes a difference. And we can always, and when there were times when Rob felt like, you know, when he was in the really dark place and he's like, why am I here? I'm a burden. You know, it was just the CTE talking to him, I believe. But I told him, you can't ever think that way again, because look what you know, your story is helping people, and you can always remember that, you know, even though you've been through all the suffering, there is something good that's come out of it. And you know, so we're just gonna keep speaking. If we have the opportunity, I'll keep speaking and telling our story and hoping that it helps people
and take it day by day.
Yeah.
Well, Emily Kelly and Rob Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.